city, flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood is torn down around me.
Hello, everybody, from that nightclub at the end of the world. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, with you today on the 18th of August in the year 2013. And today marks exactly the one-year anniversary of my arrival in Colorado from California. And there's something very relevant to what we're going to do tonight in the story about that. And I'll take a couple minutes to tell you, because I want your frame of mind, frame of reference to join me in this space. When I came here, I was absolutely 100% ready and prepared to die. As a matter of fact, on many levels and from a spiritual standpoint, I had died. I had been in Sebastopol, California, West Sonoma County, for about 15 months, enjoying a way of life that I loved. I had crops in the ground. And as a result of a decision that I could no longer ignore or not talk about or pursue wholeheartedly, my spiritual life, a number of decisions were made. I fired myself from CollapseNet. I lost pretty much everything that I owned. I arrived here in a 2008 Toyota RAV4 with everything I owned in it and my dog rags. Now it's the RAV4 is gone. I sold that to live on the equity for a while. And I now have a 2000 Lincoln Continental. It's a hoopty. It needs a new transmission. But the most important thing of all of that is that I did die, and I had died. There was no hope left. I came here with an open heart to a place that was, quite frankly, alien, but I have come to love it in this last year. But I have emerged as a new being. Since I have been here, I have evolved spiritually at a breakneck speed, thanks to a great many Native American spiritual teachers and practices which I have engaged in here. Due to the altitude at 8,100 feet in a very remote place where one becomes consciously very aware of Mother Earth and the environment and around. More than that, I will say that I have found more love here, especially love that I never thought I would be able to experience in my life, that I had dreamed of and held as an unfulfilled dream. But I was resigned when I got here. But today, as of today, there is not only in my many relationships, but in one particular relationship, I am experiencing reciprocal mutual love in ways that I had abandoned over the course of my lifetime and given up on, quite frankly. So the lesson from that is that I died, but once I died, I was reborn. And so I've been here for 1 year now, and I am here now in Colorado, and I love this place, and this is home, and I ain't leaving. But that was not available to me on my radar screen. It was not in my consciousness when I let go of everything in Northern California 1 year ago. So something else that is making me exceptionally grateful lately is my awareness that a great awakening is taking place. If you listen to Gary talking, Gary Null talking before my show started, us talking, PRN is experiencing enormous growth in terms of numbers of listeners, numbers of shows, 25 new shows coming to the network, including Max Kaiser. Derek Jensen's already got his own show on the network. You need to really check out PRN, because what we are offering is proving to be water for those thirsty in the desert. And along with that, what's really gratifying, because I pay attention to this a lot, is that I am noticing that a great many themes and ideas seem to emerge now simultaneously across a spectrum of colleagues, beloved friends, people who have been out here on the field. I am watching consciousness emerge and flower. And what I'm referring to here, I'm going to start with a very, very short essay written by Guy McPherson, who we love deeply, and who is standing shoulder to shoulder abreast with so many great people out here. And this was published today. on the website, the goodmenproject.com. One word, goodmenproject.com. Published August 18th, that's today. And this is what Guy wrote, and it fits so perfectly with what I've been agonizing over having to do in tonight's show. The title of Guy's essay is Questioning Culture, The Long Littleness of Life. Professor Guy McPherson on how we use distractions to make our lives meaningful. Guy writes, my prior essay in this space posed a series of questions. Culture discourages us from asking, much less answering, most of these questions. Throughout our lives, we spend considerable time seeking feedback from people and institutions. But the feedback we seek generally falls within a small subset of important issues. Furthermore, I question the wisdom of seeking validation, much less approval, within the realm of an irredeemably corrupt system. Some of us seek to conduct meaningful lives. However, the universe imposes upon us a meaningless existence. There is no meaning beyond the meanings we create. In attempting to create meaning, which often involves attempts to outrun our mortality, we generate distractions. We occasionally call them objectives, goals, or acts of service to others, with the result being our legacy. Yet it's too late to leave a better world for future generations of humans. The concept of leaving a legacy becomes moot when staring into the abyss of near-term human extinction. What then is the point? Are we, in the words of the English poet Francis Cornford, quote, magnificently unprepared for the long littleness of life? As we seek feedback about the condition of our lives, we simultaneously seek distractions. The distractions include the movies we watch, the books we read, the trips we take, the discussions in which we engage. The line blurs between distractions and authentic work until we are defined by the combination. The totality becomes who we are. The nature of our distractions is what makes us human, in the sense of differentiating us from other primates. Non-human primates don't read books, much less discuss them. Such distractions do not enable our survival, and in that sense are not necessities. So you have food, water, shelter. However, they are not necessarily luxuries either. Apparently, there are shades of existential gray. That's so perfect, and I'm glad to see that the orchestra has tuned up. We appear to be getting on the same page of music. I hear a drum beat, I hear a violin, I hear a piano, some piano chords, but they're starting to make a symphony. And that's what we are all about here. So, it has been a horrendously heavy week, hard week with lots of information. And one more time in my life, as I go back to the point in time when I felt compelled to tell somebody that the CIA was bringing drugs into this country, or the point in time when I felt compelled to show through investigation and writing that the economic system was hopelessly corrupt and doomed to fail, or to the point in time when I found it necessary to write Crossing the Rubicon and tell the world in a book which has never been disputed and which is in the Harvard Business Library that the United States government perpetrated the attacks of September the 11th, 2001 for the purpose of securing control of the world's oil. I proved that case, to the point where I felt it necessary to tell people about peak oil and so on. Now it is time to talk, to have that serious eyeball-to-eyeball talk about Fukushima, because the revelations this week were amazing. Now, I'm extremely pleased to report, and this is the symphony getting in their chairs, and we found the key, and the conductor, apparently, the great conductor is apparently on the stage, and in control, to write to Dr. Helen Caldicott, who has been extremely outspoken. Now, what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to play for you, because what we're going to do is we're going to look Fukushima directly in the eyeballs tonight. We are going to understand all of the implications of what has been revealed this week, and we're going to follow up next week. And Helen has agreed to be on the show. We have to pre-record probably. Next week, so I'll get you the details on that. In part two, to drive this home into consciousness that we are not We are no longer interested in distractions. We can't afford to be. Now let's roll this first clip from Helen Caldicott, then I'll come back and take us through this tonight on the Lifeboat Hour. Here's Helen.
First, I want to present this. It's produced by the New York Academy of Sciences, and it's a report on Chernobyl. Can be downloaded. Yeah. They translated 5,000 articles from Russian the first time into English. It seems that nearly a million people have already died as a result of Chernobyl, despite what WHO says and the IAEA. This is one of the most monstrous cover-ups in the history of medicine, because everybody should know about this. Then we extrapolate through to Japan. Japan is, by orders of magnitude, many times worse than Chernobyl. Never in my life did I think that 6 nuclear reactors would be at risk. I knew the 3 GE engineers who helped design these Mark 1 GE reactors. They resigned because they knew they were dangerous. So Japan built them on an earthquake fault. The reactors partially withstood the earthquake, but the tsunami, but the external electricity supply was cut off, and the external electricity supply supplies the cooling water 1 million gallons a minute to each of those 6 reactors. Without the cooling water, the water falls and the rods are so hot they melt, like at Three Mile Island and at Chernobyl. So the emergency diesel generators, which are as large as a house, got destroyed by the tsunami. So there was no way to keep the water circulating in the reactors. Also, on the roofs of the reactors, not within the containment vessel, are cooling pools. Every year they remove about 30 tons of the most radioactive rods that you could possibly imagine. Each one is 12 feet long and 1/2 inch thick. Gives out so much radiation, like X-rays, that if you stand next to it for a couple of minutes, you'll die. Not drop dead, but with... Remember Litvinenko, the Russian who got poisoned by polonium? You'll die like that, with your hair falling out, bleeding to death and dying of massive infection, like AIDS patients die. So these are, and they're thermally hot, so they have to be put in a big pool and continually cooled too. The pool has really no roof. There have been 3 hydrogen explosions blowing off the roof of the building, not the containment vessel of the core, but the roof, and exposing the cooling pool. 2 of the cooling pools are dry. They have no water in them, meaning that the nuclear fuel rods are covered with a material called zirconium. When zirconium is exposed to air, it burns, it ignites. And there have been 2 of the fueling pools at this moment are burning. In the fueling, the cooling pools are many times, you know, like 10 to 20 times more radiation than in each reactor core. In each reactor core is as much long-lived radiation as that produced by 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. We are dealing with diabolical energy. E equals mc squared. It's the energy that blows up nuclear bombs. Einstein said nuclear power is a hell of a way to boil water, because that is all nuclear power is used for, to boil water through the massive heat, turn it into steam, turn a turbine which generates electricity. Now, when you fission uranium, 200 new elements are formed, all of which are much more poisonous to the body than the original uranium. Although uranium's pretty poisonous, America used it in Fallujah and Baghdad, and in Fallujah, 80% of the babies being born are grossly deformed. They're being born without brains, single eyes, no arms. The doctors have told the women to stop having babies. The incidence of childhood cancer has gone up about 12 times. This is genocide. It's a nuclear war being conducted in Iraq. But uranium that they're using lasts for more than 4.5 billion years. So we're contaminating the cradle of civilization, the coalition of the willing. In the nuclear power plants, however, is a huge amount of radiation, 200 elements. Some last seconds, some last millions of years. Radioactive iodine lasts 6 weeks. It causes thyroid cancer. That's why people are saying, better take potassium iodide, because that blocks the thyroid uptake of radioactive iodine, which later can cause thyroid cancer. In Chernobyl, over 20,000 people have developed thyroid cancer. They have to have their thyroids out, and they will die unless they take thyroid replacement every day, like a diabetic has to take insulin. Strontium-90 will get out. It lasts for 600 years. It goes to the bone where it causes bone cancer or leukemia. Cesium lasts for 600 years. It's all over Europe. 40% of Europe is still radioactive. Turkish food is extremely radioactive. Do not buy Turkish dried apricots. Do not buy Turkish hazelnuts or dried... the Turks were so cross with the Russians, they sent all their radioactive tea over to Russia after Chernobyl. But 40% of Europe is still radioactive. Farms in Britain, their lambs are so full of cesium they can't sell them. Don't eat European food. But that's nothing compared to what's happening now. One of the most deadly is plutonium, named after Pluto, god of the underworld. 1/1,000,000 of a gram, if you inhale it, will give you cancer. Hypothetically, 1 pound, if evenly distributed, could give everyone on Earth cancer. Each reactor has 250 kilos of plutonium in it, kilograms. You only need 2.5 kilograms to make a bomb, because plutonium is what they make bombs with. It's the only country that has a reactor. From your uranium, you are the biggest exporters of uranium in the world, Cameco. Canada sells two things. It sells wheat for life and uranium for death. Right? Plutonium is going to get out and spread all over the Northern Hemisphere, and it's already heading towards North America now. Plus, radioactive iodine-129, its half-life is 17 million years, plus strontium, plus cesium, plus tritium, and I could go on and on and on. When it rains, down comes fallout, and it concentrates in food. If it gets into the sea, the algae concentrated hundreds of times, then the crustaceans concentrated hundreds of times, then the little fish, then the big fish, then us, because we stand on the apex of the food chain. You can't taste these radioactive elements, you can't see them, and you can't smell them. They're silent. When you get them inside your body, you don't suddenly drop dead of cancer. It takes 5 to 60 years to get your cancer. And when the cancer, if you feel a lump in your breast, doesn't say, I was made by some strontium-90 you ate in a piece of fish 20 years ago. All radiation is damaging. It's cumulative. Each dose you get adds to your risk of getting cancer. With americium, that's more dangerous than plutonium. I mean, I could go on and on. Depends if it rains, if you're going to get it or not. If it rains and the radiation comes down, don't grow food, don't eat the food, and I mean don't eat it for 600 years. The radioactive waste from nuclear power is going to be buried, I hear, just like next to Lake Ontario. It's going to leak, last for millions of years. It's going to get into the water, into the food chains. Radioactive waste will induce epidemics of cancer, leukemia, and genetic disease for the rest of time. This is the greatest public health hazard the world has ever witnessed, apart from the threat every day of nuclear war. Einstein said the splitting of the atom changed everything save man's mode of thinking. Very profound. Thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. We are arrogant, we have a lot of hubris, and I think the reptilian midbrain of some men's brains is pathological. We are now in a situation where we have harnessed the energy of the sun. It is totally out of control, and there's simply nothing we can do about it.
Helen Caldicott, now, most of you are going to be absolutely stunned when I tell you that this interview with Helen Caldicott was uploaded to YouTube on March 29th of 2011, about a month or so after the earthquake. If you were following me then, you will understand that I was clearly speaking of these same dangers then. But I will guarantee you that tonight you are paying a lot more attention to what she has said or what she is saying. Now, those are the basic realities about the radiation. Now, briefly, yeah, we got time. I'm going to do some of this before we go to break, and I'm going to play a song because I try to make a moral and a play out of this. There was an article that was pulled off of the Zero Hedge website. Thank God I was able to excerpt it. It appeared and then disappeared, and it was an amazingly responsible piece of journalism. But this appeared on Zero Hedge this week, and I'm just going to read some of the excerpts from that. And there's a question too when we talk about the removal of all the fuel rods. It's like, how are they going to be removed, and how are they going to be transported? Most importantly, where are they going to be stored? Because we're talking about 600 tons of stored spent fuel rods in one reactor alone. That's four or three has to be. They all have to be emptied. But the Zero Hedge story said, if one of the pools collapsed or caught fire, it could have a severe adverse impact on the United States. Indeed, a senator called it a national security concern for the U.S. The radiation caused by the failure of the spent fuel pools in the event of another earthquake could reach the West Coast within days. That absolutely makes the safe containment and protection of this spent fuel a security issue for the U.S. Nuclear expert Artie Gunderson and physician Helen Caldicott have both said that people should evacuate the northern hemisphere if one of the Fukushima fuel pools collapses. Gunderson said, quote, move south of the equator if that ever happened. I think that's probably the lesson there. Former UN advisor Akio Matsumura calls removing the radioactive materials from the Fukushima fuel pools an issue of, quote, human survival. So the stakes in decommissioning the fuel pools are high indeed. But in 3 months, TEPCO is going to start doing this very difficult operation on its own. There is a risk of inadvertent criticality if the bundles are distorted and get too close to each other. I believe there's 300 or 30 rods or 300 in a particular bin or case that weighs many tons. He was referring to an atomic chain reaction that if left unchecked, could result in a large release of radiation and heat that the fuel pool cooling system isn't designed to absorb. Of course, the fuel pool cooling system, say that three times real fast, isn't designed to absorb. Well, of course not. They're non-existent now anyway, said Gunderson. The problem with a fuel pool criticality is that you can't stop it. There are no control rods to control it. The spent fuel pool cooling system is designed only to remove decay heat, not heat from an ongoing nuclear reaction. The rods are also vulnerable to fire should they be exposed to air, Gunderson said. The pools have already boiled once due to exposure to air. Now, what's two critical factors here, one of which is all of these fuel pools, the fuel rods, were removed and handled by computers because you can't afford two rods to come into contact with each other. I mean, we are talking micrometers, millimeters of distance. Now it all has to be done by hand, but here's the kicker. The cranes that they used to do that have been destroyed, and there are no cranes close by, and robots can't get close to the building to do any of this work, for which there are no computer programs left anymore, or computers, because they succumb to the radiation. Just a beginning of the look at the serious problems here, all of which have been affected by the fact that now with 400 tons of water flowing into the Pacific and this massive groundwater flow underneath, the salt water is corroding the foundations of the building. Building 4 is teetering. And the soil, the geological substructure under the Fukushima reactors is being horrendously weakened. That's from Arne Gundersen and a great many other people like Chris Busby. That's a pretty serious situation. It's going to get more serious. But if you haven't got the picture yet, 14,000 Hiroshima bombs worth of cesium just above building number 4. You release that radiation, nobody can get to building 3. That building goes. And geographically, the circle of uninhabitability expands around. That's where we're going with this tonight in a lot more detail. So, somebody asked me this week, some young guy said, well, okay, we're all dead, so we might as well just give up and go, you know, get high. And what I responded back to him on Facebook was, when faced with imminent and certain death, a warrior makes sure to continue with daily routines of life, because that leaves open the possibility of victory. Those are my words. So here's a song, and it's a good song. Because go back to where we were at the top of the show, there is an evolution after death. And here's one of my favorite songs of all time from one of my favorite bands of all time, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Love Is Coming. Here we go. It's called Carry On, actually. Let's go.
One morning I woke up and I knew it was wrong. A new day, a new way, and new eyes to belong. The way of the mind kept on. The sky is clearing and the night is brighter. The sun become the world song. Rejoice, rejoice, we have no choice but to carry on. The fortunes of fables are able. Was it made?
To this day, they move me to this day, and how beautiful that words and songs written 40 years ago or longer carry such potent messages today. Maybe a sign that we are not as lost in space and time as we might see ourselves sometime. I'm going to roll without a break tonight. This is Michael C. Rupert on the Progressive Radio Network the show is The Lifeboat Hour. And we're here every Sunday here on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm rolling without a break. There's just too much important to say. This week, I read one of the most intellectually and professionally courageous pieces of journalism that I have ever read in my whole life. I've written a few courageous pieces, but this was just gratifying for the courage that it showed, and it's a story from Russia Today that came out this week. I'll give you the date, but it was up on Facebook. Here's the title: Fukushima Apocalypse. Years of quote duct tape fixes could result in millions of deaths. RT. There was no byline with this, but I was so moved by this and so grateful for the timing of its appearance, because I was getting, quite frankly, really sick of distractions and people who are not who want to talk about something like, hey, a SWAT team raided an organic farm in Texas. Let's focus our attention on that. Well, we know the world's corrupt. You know, hey, somebody did this here, or some legal action happened here, or some tech company bought something connected to, and I'm going, what is wrong with you idiots? Before I read this article, I'm going to read you some chilling excerpts from it. I posted on Facebook, and this is what I sent to all my Facebook friends. Read every word of this. This is real journalism, the best kind. The following brief excerpt not only opens the door to much deeper concerns at the end of the story. Forget the not. Nothing you read all day, all week, or all month will be as important as reading this and taking it into your consciousness. And think, please think, before posting comments and stories about people faking wounds for cameras in Egypt, or the definition of money and what I meant when I spoke about changing the way money works, or about so many extraneous, trivial, unimportant things. I awoke this morning to more than 100 messages about trivialities and things that do not make a rat's ass worth of difference to these life and death problems. A little over a week ago, I wrote here that we needed to simplify and focus on important things. This is my Facebook page. I read every post here to keep this page functional, and that's the way it will stay. Either you will protect and respect my time and health, or I will block you. When you get to crisis situations, you got to make decisions. What you are about to read in this excerpt is not the worst news. This article lays out all of the issues very clearly. Either you are mature enough and strong enough to read and absorb it, or you are not. I will not be diverted down hysterical side alleys of useless discussion, nor will this page. We put music and art and laughs up to strengthen each other at my discretion. The issues are Fukushima, climate collapse, resource shortages, and unprecedented violence and repression, not whether somebody faked a video, who did it, or why. The issues are also whether or not we see solid, tangible evidence of a shift in human consciousness that renders archaic, obsolete, and irrelevant the infinite growth paradigm. Now, this is an excerpt that I'm going to read you here from the RT story, Fukushima Apocalypse, Years of Duct Tape Fixes Could Result in Millions of Deaths. Quote, There are numerous other reasons that this will be a dangerous undertaking. That's the removal of the fuel rods. The racks inside the pool that contained this fuel were damaged by the explosion in the early days of the accident. There were explosions at 3 and 4. Zirconium cladding, which encased the rods, burned when water levels dropped, but to what extent the rods have been damaged is not known and probably won't be until removal is attempted. Saltwater cooling has caused corrosion of the pool walls and probably the fuel rods and racks. The building is sinking. The cranes that normally lift the fuel were destroyed. Computer-guided removal will not be possible. Everything will have to be done manually. TEPCO cannot attempt this process without humans, which will manage this enormous task while being bombarded with radiation during the extraction and casking. The process of removing each rod will have to be repeated over 1,500 times without incident. Moving damaged nuclear fuel under such complex conditions could result in a criticality if the rods come into close proximity to one another, which would then set off a chain reaction that cannot be stopped. I think it was Chris Busby said an open-air nuclear extravaganza, something like that. Got to have the dark humor. Open-air fission reaction. It's never been contemplated. What could potentially happen is the contents of the pool could burn and or explode, and the entire structure sustain further damage or collapse. This chain reaction process could be self-sustaining and go on for a long time. This is the apocalyptic scenario in a nutshell, and what I added to that was, if and when that happens, all six reactors at Fukushima become untouchable and will go exactly the same way. Building 4 is next to Building 3, same amount of 14,000 Hiroshima bombs worth of spent fuel on top of the roof of a building that's exploded. When that happens, the radiation will be so intense, no other reactors in Japan will be approachable. Why? Is that, and this is what Helen Caldicott and I are going to talk about. There are six reactors at Fukushima Daiichi. I think there's another four or six nearby at Fukushima Daini. Once the chain reaction starts, it triggers the chain reaction in from 4 to 3, or three goes first, then it triggers at 4. But then no one will be able to approach reactor 2, which has also lost its core, which is down somewhere deep in the earth doing things we are not quite sure about to the water table and getting worse. Building 1, and then no one will ever be able to approach to maintain the reactors at Fukushima Daini. And northern Japan, according to one quote I found this week, should already be deemed uninhabitable. But when that happens, human beings will not be able to venture there. And how many of us have even begun to think about the knowing, willing sacrifice? And I will call them samurai, following an intense code of honor. All of the workers who go there and knowingly submit themselves to what are lethal doses of radiation. They're not able to hide those facts much longer, but pretty soon no one will even be able to function near a reactor. All reactors require human maintenance. So, I just looked at a map before the start of this show, and I hope I pasted it in there. I put it in here somewhere. I know I did. There's something like 82 or 84 commercial and research reactors in Japan, roughly spread half and half between northern and southern Japan. Then I looked a little further, and of course in Korea there's another 15 or 20, or 10 or 15, including North Korea. You get to the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia, you know there are reactors there. You get to eastern China, and there are reactors all over the place, and the radiation from Fukushima, what will spread as ripples of a pond from the collapse of Building 4, doom all of those places to being A, uninhabitable, B, unworkable, and C, unmaintainable. In other words, and you see how that will spread to the point where, eventually, soon, because and we'll talk about this with Helen, but I did hear Arne Gunderson and many others say that, you know, the West Coast could become uninhabitable within days of an open-air fission reaction. at Fukushima, which now I would say looks to be fairly certain. So that's what we need to get into our consciousness before we try to, as Guy McPherson was talking about, sink and mire away and lose our focus in distractions. Climate change, of course, is incredibly important, and that's affecting many of us, and we do need to remain aware of how fast and where that is happening. Who knows, it may have an effect at Fukushima Daiichi, but it is certainly weakening the ability of the planet even to consider responding to this crisis, which is now, if it is not clear to you, I've been saying it since the earthquake happened, this is a human problem, and there is nothing more pressing, and if we don't get on the same page, we're doomed. But it's the change in consciousness which is more important than anything else. And I think on that note, I'm going to play a second song tonight. And when we come back, we'll take your calls, and we'll see how well people can stay on point and on focus with this. But the second song we play tonight on the nightclub at the end of the world is from New White Trash's new album, Age of Authority, which has been out since July 17th. People are liking it, love it. And for those of you who don't know, I am a singer-songwriter, don't play any instruments. But thanks to my bandmate, band leader, Doug Lewis, here, who I live with in Moffat, Colorado, and many years of experience as a bar singer years ago. That's all I ever wanted to be. I've discovered that I can write songs in terms of melody and words and lyrics, and I happen to sing the lead on this song, and I will ask you to open your consciousness to receive a song from our new album, Age of Authority, called Son of Your Love.
Verse of the lie, the one that holds you down and keeps you paralyzed. By now you know the last and first name of the one. Big Brother wraps your fear and burns a shadow in the sun. Son of your love,
in the son of your
son, in the son of your
love.
Shadow's gonna fall.
Son of your
love,
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 son of your
love.
Well, Son of Your Love from New White Trash, yours truly singing the lead on a song I'm exceptionally proud of. You can find that song and 16 more from our new album at the website newwhitetrash.com. There are options to listen for free, buy to download, or buy a CD, all there. You can find that. Thank you for that, and it's been a standard theme on this show for as long as I've been here, that with a little art, without a little music, and without a love, we are not going to be strong enough. We are not going to be able to do what we have to do without letting some love and some balance into our life. Back to this RT story, Fukushima apocalypse, years of duct tape fixes could result in millions of deaths. The date was August 17, 2013. It was edited August 18th. And posted then 2013 at 1341 hours. I love good journalism. I wish there was a byline here because this is amazingly courageous writing. And I would love to shake the hand of the man or woman or man who wrote this. Whoever they are heroic to me, and I so appreciate heroism and intellectual courage. I'm going to read some more excerpts from that. Subheading in the article, the site has been propped up with duct tape and a kickstand for over 2 years, quoting from the RT story. Many of their fixes are only temporary, as there are so many issues to address, and cost always seems to be an enormous factor in what gets implemented and what doesn't. Until you change the way money works, you change nothing. As a comparison, Chernobyl was one reactor in a rural area a quarter of the size of one of the reactors at Fukushima. There was no spent fuel pool to worry about. Chernobyl was treated in situ, meaning everything was pretty much left where it was while the effort to contain it was made, and very expeditiously, I might add, not only above ground, but below ground. At Fukushima, we have six top floor pools all loaded with fuel that will eventually have to be removed, the most important being reactor 4, although reactor 3 is in pretty bad shape too. Spent fuel pools were never intended for long-term storage. They were only to assist short-term movement of fuel. Using them as a long-term storage pool is a huge mistake that has become an acceptable practice and repeated at every reactor site worldwide. How many Mark 1s are there in the United States by GE? We have three 100-ton melted fuel blobs underground, but where exactly they are located, no one knows. Whatever barriers TEPCO has put in place so far have failed. Efforts to decontaminate radioactive water have failed. Robots have failed. Camera equipment and temperature gauges failed. Decontamination of surrounding cities has failed. Now catch this. This is a slug for the next section. If and when the corium reaches the Tokyo aquifer, serious and expedient discussions will have to take place about evacuating 40 million people. That's a quote. And if this is the context, we have endless releases into the Pacific Ocean that will be ongoing for not only our lifetimes, but our children's lifetimes. We have 40 million people living in the Tokyo area nearby. We have continued releases from the underground corium that remind us it is there occasionally with steam events and huge increases in radiation levels. Across the Pacific, that's the west coast of the U.S., we have at least two peer-reviewed scientific studies so far that have already provided evidence of increased mortality in North America and thyroid problems in infants on the West Coast states from our initial exposures. We have increasing contamination of the food chain through bioaccumulation and biomagnification. And a newly stated concern is the proximity of melted fuel in relation to the Tokyo aquifer that extends under the plant. If and when the corium levels reach the Tokyo aquifer, serious and expedient discussions will have to take place about evacuating 40 million people from the greater metropolitan area. As impossible as this sounds, you cannot live in an area which does not have access to safe water. That's a theme we've been talking about here. Continuing in the quotes, the operation to begin removing fuel from such a severely damaged pool has never been attempted before. The rods are unwieldy and very heavy, each one weighing two-thirds of a ton, but it has to be done unless there is some way to encase the entire building in concrete with the pool as it is. I don't know of anyone discussing that option, but it would seem much safer than what they are about to attempt, but not without its own set of risks. And the Russians will tell you this is me talking now, that they have to encase underneath with the concrete as well, which the Russians were able to do. But you cannot encase in concrete when you have hundreds of tons of water, radioactive water, flowing daily, seawater, corrosive, undermining the foundations of the building. So forget that one. Continuing with the story, and all this collateral damage will continue for decades, if not centuries, even if things stay exactly the way they are now. But that is unlikely, as bad things happen, like natural disasters and deterioration with time, earthquakes, subsidence, and corrosion, to name a few. How about economic collapse, which I have to talk about? Every day that goes by, the statistical risk increases for this apocalyptic scenario. No one can say or know how this will play out, except that millions of people will probably die, even if things stay exactly as they are, and billions could die if things get any worse. This was an interview, and I'm going to scroll up here. It was an interview with Russia Today and CC, and I have to find out who the CC was. You need to find this story. It is still up on the RT site. I am looking at it right now. Fukushima apocalypse, years of duct tape fixes could result in millions of deaths. The interview was with Christina Consolo, and so here is a big tip of the hat, high five, and salute of honor and respect to Christina Consolo. And she's a nuclear expert. And all of this that I have read you and all of this that's in this article is, if you've been following me for any length of time, you know that these are all scenarios that I have been positing since the earthquakes occurred, just connecting the dots using analytical thinking. And compiling the evidence, like I've done my whole life with every other thing that I've been so right about over all these years. So, what I'm trying to do tonight, we're down to the last 6 minutes of the show. Maybe we have time for one call. Somebody wants to call in. Let's see what Spirit arranges. 888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888. This is now something that I need to play. This is my role. It's my job. I'm tracker of truth. I need to see, you've all seen scenes in a movie where you have some airhead character, a man or a woman, you know, who's standing up ranting about something that they find extremely important, totally oblivious to the fact that that they're standing in the middle of a railroad track or a car is bearing down on them at, you know, 100 miles an hour, or that an eagle is, you're totally oblivious to that, and then somebody in the movie kind of whisks them out of the way to get their attention back at the last moment. And it is so critical that I do everything I can. It is my duty of as tracker of truth. I have been a scout and a messenger my whole life to tell all of you and to help us all focus our consciousness on the fact that there is nothing more important than this. Now, it may not be solvable from a Cartesian three-dimensional standpoint for myriad reasons, but there are different levels of consciousness that become available when, spiritually speaking, we hit a bottom, when our backs are to the wall, when we are faced really and seriously with a choice of evolve or perish, grow up or die. And the one thing that has to happen, and it has to happen right now. And this is why I am so sick of the horrible bloodshed in Egypt, which is out of control. I am so sick of so many situations around the world and around the country with SWAT teams raiding organic farms and ranchers and farmers in Texas and New Mexico selling their fresh water to fracking companies while nearby towns are going dead because they've depleted their aquifers, and these people who happen to have water are selling it for profit. All of these things are absolutely horrendous, but nothing is as important to us, because there will be no solution for 7 billion humans on this planet, many of whom are rapidly awakening, until all 7 billion of us get on the same page. And for tonight, on the Lifeboat Hour, on this show, at this moment in time, I feel that I have discharged a very unpleasant duty, because I have had to sit here and I have had to, like, Cher was in the movie Pizza Moon. What was the movie? She slaps Nicolas Cage and goes, snap out of it. Well, that's what I'm doing tonight. That's my job. We need to understand this, because as we share this consciousness, we find in it our compassion for each other and our connectedness for each other. There are no more Japanese, Russians, Egyptians, Muslims, Christians, Muslim brother, military. There are only 7 billion human beings, and all of our lives are hanging in the balance. And the question is, will we be able to see and recognize that in time? And if we do, I can guarantee you that something wonderful will happen, as it happened a year ago when I died in Northern California and came here to be reborn. We face the shadows. We walk toward them. We don't distract. We don't divert. We are spiritual adults. Our lives are on the line, and let the heroes step forth. Now, I got a one last minute call. We got 2 minutes left. Ulysses from New Jersey, you're going to have to talk fast. What do you got to say?
Oh, I was listening to the words that you were saying about the being on the same page. It was a note that my father told me the other day. He had like an issue with health, and I asked him, Daddy, why don't you stop doing what you're doing? I mean, you know it's not good for you. And he told me, like, buddy, I cannot live that way, just like that. And I tell him, well, that'd be your answer.
There it is. That was a perfect call. That was a perfect call right at the end of the show. We are totally out of time, but I want to thank you for that. Somehow, some way, a moment of clarity may strike us all, and we can decide what's important and what's not. But right now, all 7 billion of us are, and we know what the problem is. It's right in our faces. So the problem got really simple. Ulysses and everybody out there, this is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, here with you on the Lifeboat Hour. I'll be back to you next week. We may have a pre-recorded show, but I will have Helen Caldicott on to speak so eloquently for herself on a show we're probably going to pre-record this week. All right, I love all of you. Hang tough, be willing to die, and I'll meet you on the other side. See you next week.